COVID-19 has dramatically changed K-12 education in North Carolina. That change isn't confined to the last 2 years alone. It's safe to say that education has changed for the foreseeable future. The ripple effects of the pandemic will continue to be felt for years to come. Helping North Carolina grow into that future is the purpose of a new Parent Advisory Commission created by Superintendent of Public Instruction Catherine Truitt. The commission's purpose is to give parents a voice in their kids' education, to get feedback and input from parents on creating an education system that works for everyone. Superintendent Truitt announced the creation of the advisory board back in February. Here's how the new commission works. It's composed of 48 total members that will include 6 parents or guardians from each of the state's 8 educational regions. Importantly, the commission will include the voices of parents from schools of choice in addition to the voice of parents from traditional public schools. Each component of the commission will include 1 parent from a public charter school, 1 from a homeschool, and 1 from a private school. That's in addition to the 2 parents from a traditional public school and 1 at-large public school parent from the largest county in each region. In today's episode, we're going to chat with Superintendent Truitt about the commission and what the future of K-12 education looks like in North Carolina. Carolina Journal is your source for daily news and commentary in North Carolina covering politics and public policy. A project of the John Locke Foundation, Carolina Journal is a pioneer in nonprofit and investigative journalism. Our work has exposed corruption, conflicts of interest, and misuse of public funds by public officials, including members of Congress and members of the North Carolina General Assembly. In season 2 of Extreme Injustice, North Carolina students and their families made life-changing sacrifices after state policies shuttered public schools across the state. Our deep dive into the unintended consequences of COVID lockdowns shows the desperate need for new thinking in public education. Superintendent Truitt, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
First, I'd just love to hear kind of a little bit about the origins of the Parent Advisory Commission, how the idea came about, and why did you launch it?
The idea came about when I was attending the Excel and Ed conference in Florida that, for your listeners who don't know, this is Governor Jeb Bush's education nonprofit foundation. They do a lot of work with all states on various kinds of education issues. And I heard him speak in December about a potential parent bill of rights that was happening in other states. And I thought, wow, that's incredibly interesting to me, especially at that time when we were hearing so much about school board meetings and parents feeling frustrated that open school board meetings were not really open. At the same time, we know that the Department of Justice was referring to some parents as terrorists. And I thought to myself, this is two completely different extremes. And also I will add that I was hearing from all kinds of school board members about their frustrations across the spectrum. And so I thought we need to be lifting up parent voice. There's so much that happened during the pandemic that gave parents a front row view of their kids' education that perhaps they hadn't seen before. They were sitting next to their children in some cases, watching them do virtual school. I think some parents came away feeling like, wow, I have a brand new respect for my child's teacher. And other parents came away thinking, oh my goodness, I need to pull my child out of public school. And where do we find the balance where's the middle ground there? And so, yeah, I left Florida thinking we need to give parents more of a voice.
What do you think was one of the big takeaways that I had? Was I had the exact same situation sitting next to my child watching this happen. I had both of those reactions.
Yes.
I can't imagine being in the situation of being a teacher in virtual school, just turning on a dime. What do you think those key lessons are that schools, and particularly your role, I can't imagine having overseen something so dramatic in American history, particularly for schools. What do you think are the key lessons you're taking away and that the rest of the school systems, teachers, principals are?
From the pandemic?
From the pandemic.
Well, I think that the one of the biggest key lessons for me is that all children were impacted by the pandemic. Mm-hmm. All children suffered learning loss during the pandemic. And throughout the pandemic, there were those that said, no, kids are not losing, they might be losing instructional time, but they are not losing learning. And we know that that's not true. And we do our students and their parents a disservice to claim that that's not true. And so I think we have to be honest with ourselves, first of all, about what the consequences were of closing schools for as long as we did. I think another takeaway for me is that our teachers were, I think, forever impacted by the pandemic. I think we're going to have teachers who do not look back on this time fondly at all, and are perhaps loath to look at this as a period of innovation. I think our teachers did the best they could with what they had. But at the same time, there is sort of that dichotomy of we have an opportunity to do things differently moving forward. And that's certainly where my head is. And I have the luxury of being in that space, having the role that I do. And so I want to share where my head is with parents, with teachers, with principals, with local superintendents, and the legislature. Because it's so easy to just go right back to the way we used to do things. And I think it's much easier than people think it is, that we'll just continue to say the purpose of third grade is to get ready for fourth grade, and the purpose of fourth grade is to get ready for fifth grade, and that's really not the way we should be approaching public education.
Sure.
So for the advisory commission then, what's kind of the end deliverable that you're hoping to get from that? What's the end game there?
Well, largely, I would like for the parents to answer that question. But in my mind, what I think of is kind of the same way it works with my teacher advisory group and my principal advisory group, and I have a student advisory group as well. And in those situations, when I need to know how principals in general are going to react to a change or a new piece of legislation or some idea, I know where I can go to kind of get a feel for what the temperature is. I think it's important to have that with parents too. Mm-hmm. I envision parents providing formal written feedback. I envision showing them how they can go to the legislature and advocate on behalf of their children and their schools at the legislature. I think there's myriad ways that parent voice can be lifted up, but I also would like to see some kind of cross-functionality between our teachers and our parents. Sure. And our principals and our parents. I think that is how I run the Department of Public Instruction. We're highly cross-functional. We're not siloed. And I think that there's great opportunity for understanding when we have as many channels of communication as possible.
Mm-hmm. Now, at a recent Board of Education meeting, there was a interesting moment, I think, where a few of the other members brought up some criticism of the parent commission regarding how it was the composition of it.
Yes.
So as I mentioned before, it has a parent, each segment has a parent from a homeschool, from a charter school, and from a private school. And now in North Carolina, we have about 1/4 of the K-12 students are from schools of choice, and that's been growing even in recent years, especially. So what's kind of your reaction to that? Why did you want to make sure those voices were represented on the mm-hmm. parent commission? What are your thoughts on mm-hmm. that?
Well, first of all parents have a story to tell. And we need to know in public education what that story is. If homeschooling were a school district, it would be the third largest district in our state after Wake and Charlotte. That's a lot of kids. That's a lot of parents who have said, I am opting out of the public school system in order to homeschool my child. And we've seen homeschooling numbers increase even more during the pandemic. So I think what's interesting to me, and this is what I shared with my fellow board members, that our best superintendents across our state take the attitude that they are all our children. Okay? So if I am a third grade student who has been homeschooled since kindergarten. And now my parent's situation has changed. My maybe perhaps a parent is going to go back to work. So now I need to go to school. So now I'm going from being homeschooled to being in a traditional public school. Or I attend a charter school that ends in eighth grade, and now I'm going to go to a traditional public high school. Or you have a family, this is very common, where we have families that have one child in private school and one child in public school. And I will tell you that 99% of our applications, of our applicants, indicate that more than one form of schooling has been used. That does not surprise me at all. But yeah, I was very surprised to see that focus on the percentage of the council that would be traditional public school versus not being, because in my mind, I was thinking, oh, 67% of this council will be public school parents.
Right.
But that wasn't enough. And in order for it to truly be representational of the makeup in our state, I would have had to create a 96-person council, which I kind of felt was silly.
Yeah. Well, and you bring up something, a really important point. A lot of families have fluctuated, even within one child's life or educational career, between public, private, homeschool, charter, traditional. For one reason or another, they needed something different, or they just aged out of one type of school.
Right.
Do you feel like these options are taking away or somehow creating a negative effect on a traditional public school, or do you think it really is an ecosystem where they can feed each other?
Well, it should be the ecosystem where they can feed each other.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we've got superintendents that really work with their charter schools in their communities, that they'll work with the private schools, the homeschool families. I would disagree with the idea that it takes away from our public school system. I'm not about protecting the system of public education. I'm about protecting and improving outcomes for students who are in our public schools, absolutely 100%. But if we're going to be the first choice for families, then we need to understand why some families are choosing not to send their kids to us.
Sure.
I want to know, why is that? And so for me to claim to be lifting up the voices of parents and to not include that sector of our population, I think would be foolish.
Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back with Superintendent of Public Instruction, Catherine Truitt.
Extreme Injustice, an investigative project of Carolina Journal, is produced by the John Locke Foundation. For three decades, Locke has served as an independent, nonprofit think tank that works for truth, freedom, and the future of North Carolina. Locke envisions a strong North Carolina committed to individual freedom, personal responsibility, and limited constitutional government. To support our work, please visit johnlocke.org.
Carolina Journal is your source for news and commentary covering politics and public policy. As a project of the John Locke Foundation, Carolina Journal is a pioneer in nonprofit investigative journalism. Our work has exposed corruption, conflicts of interest, and misuse of taxpayer funds by public officials, including members of Congress and the state legislature. Visit carolinajournal.com to learn more.
Welcome back to Extreme Injustice, Stolen Time. We're here with Superintendent of Public Instruction, Catherine Truitt. We've been talking about a new parent advisory commission that she has created to hear feedback from parents across the state on what our K-12 education system should look like. I want to ask real quick here, I know that the application is still open. We're recording this episode on March 24th. I know the application is still open through the end of the month if parents are interested in applying for the commission. What's the response been like?
We've gotten over 1,000 applications so far, so we're really happy with the interest, and we will be, I believe, have our first convening in June.
That's exciting.
Yeah, very exciting.
Wow. Wow. They're from all over the state because of the composition.
That's exactly right. We actually have gone to great lengths to make the commission as diverse as possible. It will be geographically diverse. We sent out the application to all of our homeless liaisons, to our migrant liaisons, our exceptional children's division liaisons, and of course it will be fully representational geographically. So yeah, we're really excited.
That is exciting.
I wanted to shift gears a little bit then to close out our time. I'd love to just hear your thoughts kind of more broadly on how K-12 public education has changed as a result of the pandemic and kind of what the future looks like in your estimation.
So I would say that one of the things that we're really, really focused on right now is the power of early literacy. And so we worked with the Senate in particular to revamp the Excellence in Public Schools Act so that we could be sure that our teachers have the skills and education necessary to ensure that all students are reading before third grade. And the way to do this, the research is very clear, is to deploy a phonics-based approach to early literacy instruction, which is something that as a nation and as a state, we've largely not been doing for the past 40 years. And so our reading scores have been stagnant for decades because we have not been using evidence-based methods of early literacy instruction. And so we are using federal dollars right now to train and educate all pre-K through fifth grade teachers in a phonics-based approach to early literacy. It will be a game changer for all students in our state. And then kind of at the other end of the K-12 spectrum, we're looking at the role that K-12 education plays in workforce development. We've got, anywhere from between 25 to 30% of kids graduate from high school every year and have no clue what they're going to do. And they are completely disengaged from any kind of post-secondary education or workforce opportunity. So we want for all students to have some kind of career and education plan as they transition into high school. And so that they and their parents know what are all of the opportunities. I think we've done so many kids a disservice by saying all kids need to go to a four-year residential college experience after high school. It's just not the case. There are many pathways to the middle class, and we owe it to our students to really understand what waits for them after they cross that graduation stage.
That's exciting. We have such a robust economy and lots of manufacturing, so many opportunities for students. Do you find that really they need to get that message early in high school, and that's part of the problem? They fall off late because they're not thinking about it?
Absolutely. And I think that their parents are often not aware of what all of the opportunities are and how to access those opportunities. I think the data is pretty clear. Only about 22% of kids graduate from high school every year in North Carolina and attain a four-year degree before they're 24.
Oh, that's wow. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and only 31% are getting any kind of post-secondary credential by the time they're 24.
Wow. I did not realize that.
Yeah, we've got some work to do.
Yeah, well, lots of room for growth. That's exciting.
Yeah, it is. Good. Very exciting. Yeah.
So I also wanted to ask you about the school funding issue. Right now, we've got, obviously, the ongoing Leandro school funding case that's been going on for close to three decades now. A lot of chatter in the media on this, a lot of debate in the legislature and the judiciary on this. I know you had some thoughts, though, on how we currently fund our schools in some ways. Maybe we could improve that.
Well, I actually think that the way that we fund our public schools is incredibly equitable. If we're defining equity as giving all students what they need when they need it, which is how we should be defining equity, we actually give more money to students who have some sort of learning difficulty, to students who are English language learners, and or students who are low income, such that if I live in Wake County and I am none of those things, my per pupil expenditure is probably about $6,400 a year. But if I am all three of those things in Wake County, my per pupil expenditure is about $18,600 a year. That's a big difference. So it's that weighted formula that ensures that children who need more money to be educated and to be successful get more money. Now, whether or not that's enough money is that's a conversation for another time. But I do get frustrated in general in the media with the lack of accurate and clear reporting on how much money we fund public schools. In North Carolina, unlike many states in the North, for example, we fund the bulk of funding for public schools comes from the state, not the local level. Only 23% of funding comes from the local level. And that is truly where the inequities in funding lie. If you live in a large county with a big tax base, you're going to get more money per student. But again, that's only 23% of the funding that a school gets.
Sure. Now, is there a, you know, we were talking a little bit about this ongoing Leandro case, and it seems like our state budget actually funded much of that. What is your experience, and what have you seen coming out of the legislature lately?
Yeah, so the Comprehensive Remedial Plan was a plan, that is the name of the plan that Judge Lee ordered to be funded in the amount of $1.7 billion. So the legislature in this past long session funded public education with $1.5 billion of new recurring funding. So we're talking about $1.7 billion order from the judge, which was right before the budget was signed, versus what was actually funded of $1.5 billion in new recurring funding. And that, again, is just not something you read about in the media.
That's not the cavernous gap that we keep hearing
about.
That's
exactly right. That's exactly right.
Very interesting. Wow.
I know there was also a new rule that came down from the Biden administration and just recently breaking news that definitely has an impact on North Carolina. And this has to do with a topic that's very in the news and controversial right now. It's gender. Tell us some about what that is.
Yeah. So over the past year, the Biden administration decided that gender should now be protected, should be part of the protections afforded by FERPA, as well as through Title IX, which deals with discrimination. And so to that end, all school information systems in the country, and in North Carolina, this would be PowerSchool, which we have a statewide system in North Carolina, now are required to hide gender as a matter of protection under FERPA and under discrimination with Title IX. What that means is that when a teacher receives her class roster, they will not be able to see gender on that roster. Now, if the principal decides that she wants the teachers to see gender, then that principal can decide to do that. But it does kind of beg the question about, you know, why is gender being protected in for elementary school students, for example? But yeah, it's something that came down to us about 6 weeks ago. So that change has now been made in PowerSchool.
Sure. Very interesting. So it's not the case, as I've seen in other outlets, that parents or families or children can go in and change their gender in PowerSchool. Oh, that is not the case.
That is not the case. That's absolutely correct. Yeah, a parent cannot even go in and change their child's gender in PowerSchool, let alone a student or a teacher.
Sure.
That's right. Yeah.
Interesting. I'm glad we cleared that one up.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
That was alarming.
Yes.
It was. Yeah.
Well, Superintendent Truitt, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. It's been a great discussion.
Thank you, David and Donna. The pleasure was all mine.
And thank you for your service to our state. I really appreciate it. I have students in public school, and your sacrifices are appreciated.
Thank you very much.
Stay tuned for our next episode of Extreme Injustice, Stolen Time. Extreme Injustice is an investigation series from the Carolina Journal, the media project of the John Locke Foundation. Visit carolinajournal.com today and sign up for our free email newsletter to stay up to date on news from the state capital and how it impacts your business, home, and community.